So, okay, now, Exodus chapter 1, starting in verse 1, we're going to read through verse 7. And these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, Joseph being already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all of his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now, one of the blessings of God for Israel was offspring, and lots of it. Does anybody want to venture a guess as to why?
Creating a government.
He's creating a nation, isn't it? A bloodline and a nation. So they are going to be prolific, period. They're going to pretty much reproduce like rabbits. And that's what they were doing. And even in their homeland, they were overrunning in population the very Egyptians who had been there for thousands of years. And they'd only shown up for a short period of time. So, God's showing favor to them. Yes,
That's what's happening with the Muslims.
Yeah, yes, it is. You're right. Of course, you also have got the benefit that the Muslims do not at large kill their babies. So, if you keep all of them, you might wind up, outrunning other people pretty quickly. Exodus chapter 1, looking at verse 8 through 11. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, Joseph already being dead, of course. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us." Too many and too mighty. Not only is there a lot of them, but they're pretty impressive, obviously. He didn't say they could overcome us by sheer numbers. He said they're also strong, right? More mighty than us. "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join with our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now, if you remember back in Genesis chapter 47, in verse 11 specifically, it told us that Joseph and Pharaoh had given them the land of Ramses, which was good for what? What was that land good for?
Everything.
It
was
fertile.
No.
It was fertile and for the sheep.
It was good for sheep. It wasn't fertile for sheep,
yeah.
But yes, it was good for sheep, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, it was good grazing land, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was made for. That was what it was set apart for. And of course, all of Israel at that point, all of his brothers were shepherds. So it was the perfect thing, right? Not only that, but they were given houses and the land itself. Remember, how did that make them different than everybody else?
Because they were given the land and everybody else had to sell their land.
That's right.
So
at this particular point, right now, going into this other Pharaoh, unless some people were able to procure more land, which some of them might, it still would have been a rarity. You've got the people of Israel have got their own spot of land that they own.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in it, everything produced by it is theirs.
Mm-hmm.
That made them unique. It made them powerful. Are you following?
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of Egypt was pretty much dirt poor, other than the priest and Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh was ridiculously rich because, remember, money was given to him. Oh, the land was given to him. The people themselves were given to him as servants just so they could have food on their table, right?
Yeah.
Now, this was one Pharaoh ago, but still, the situation probably hasn't changed. There's nothing that gives us indication that all the people were able to get back their land. More than likely, they did not.
Yeah, Pharaoh's not going to give up a good thing.
Yeah, no, of course not. Absolutely not. So it's important that you remember that that was a scenario, that was a situation that this Pharaoh came into. He didn't know Joseph. He had no special feeling for the Israelites. All he knew was, hey, someone other than me has got a lot of land and has got power and authority over that land, and they're not Egyptians. And because they're different than us, if Egypt comes into war, they might side with our enemies and wage war against us, and we wouldn't stand a chance, right? So we need to grab a hold of this while we can, before they multiply so much in number that nothing could be done about it, right? So it was a real threat that he was just trying to assail before it got any further. Yes, you look like you had something.
Yeah, I have a question. Didn't at some point Joseph sell the land back to some of the Egyptians?
If he did, I don't know it. I was thinking
that. No, they gave it to him, and then he had thought maybe at one point he sold it back. I don't know.
If he did, I don't remember that. I may have just twisted it in my head. So remember, during the 3 years of the famine, which ravaged most of the Middle East, all the inhabitants of Egypt sold all their land. So all the best of the pasture land, everything, all belonged to Israel. So it's under these circumstances that the Israelites grew in number and in wealth. Let's see. What now? It says that he made them make supply cities or cities of treasuries, depending on what translation you read. But there's not a lot to describe what that means. So I did a little bit of digging, and it's largely just guesswork, because there's been anybody you read from has got their own guess, which tells me that nobody really knows for a fact what it is. But the words themselves give us a little bit of a clue. The word cities could refer to a traditional city or town, or even to a military base. So these may have been warehouse areas protected by military personnel, or they may have actually been cities. According to Wikipedia, which is exactly not the best source in the world for accurate information, but this one seemed to have good references, which you have to really pay attention to with Wikipedia, because they'll give you references, but when you follow through with them, a lot of times, which most people I know, I'm one of the few people that ever bother to do that, but if you actually look down the footnotes and follow up who they reference, sometimes they're people with such a ridiculous bias you couldn't trust what they said in the first place. So you have to be very careful with Wikipedia. I mean, hugely. This is not a whole lot better than getting your news from Facebook. But, you know, if it is well-referenced, it's valuable. If it's not well-referenced, it's not. This seemed fairly well-referenced. So according to Wikipedia, the Bible description describes Ramses as a store city. The exact meaning of the Hebrew phrase is not certain, but some have suggested that it refers to supply depots on or near the frontier. This would be an accurate description for Pithom in the 6th century BC, but not for the royal capital in the time of Ramses, when the nearest frontier was far off in the north of Syria. Now, you notice, when we read this, it did not say that they were to do the supply city in Ramses while Ramses was alive. It just said in the city of. So it still could easily be the same thing that this is talking about, because nowhere in the passage does it say during the time of Ramses. In fact, we know that the guy that was ruling wasn't Ramses. Okay, so it had to be many, many generations after Ramses, because Ramses wasn't the guy that was alive even during Pharaoh. So he's at least three generations, if not further, from Ramses. Okay, so when the nearest frontier was far off in the north Syria. Only after the original function of Pi Ramses had been forgotten could the ruins have been reinterpreted as a fortress on Egypt's frontier. On the other hand, it is also possible that these may have been cities built for the pyramid builders. Contrary to popular belief, about 99% of, contrary to popular belief and about 99% of films about ancient Egypt, the pyramids were in fact not built by slaves, but instead by Egyptian workers. These workers were not few in number either. Some of the work crews were large enough to warrant the building of entire cities to support them for these decade-long building projects. So it's very possible that is what they're talking about. It may have been, like I said, these two cities, definitely Pithom, was that what it was? And possibly Ramses may have been cities that are out on the outer skirts of the frontier land where they're building brand new stuff that haven't been built before. And they just built, they commissioned the Israelites to build a city that was a supply city that the people would come to sleep at night. That'd be where the supplies were. And that's where they left in the morning to go do work for the building of the pyramids. So at least that's entirely possible. That's what this was about. Later on, of course, in chapter 5, which we're not going to get to tonight, of course, you see that that the Egyptians were, it was laid upon, and actually it mentions it here as well in the early chapters, that the Israelites actually were commissioned to be people that were making bricks. So they probably were not only the ones that built the city, but they also were probably the ones that filled the supply city with the supplies, at least the bricks anyway. So anyway, so that gives you a little bit of a backdrop of what the verses are talking about. Now, in Exodus chapter 1, starting verse 12, who wants to read verse 12 through 22 for me?
I'm sorry, what?
Chapter 1, verse 12 through 22. Who's going to read that for me?
I will.
Thank you.
But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of the midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided household for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.
All right. Now, the midwives honored God, even in their lying. Right? Because they told Pharaoh a bold-faced lie, didn't they?
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that the midwives did not give, I mean, the mothers or the pregnant women didn't give birth quickly and more lively than the Egyptians, but they were lying that they couldn't show up in time, you know? It was just a way of trying to sidestep the issue. And yet God honored them and blessed them even in their lie. Why is that?
Because they put him first.
Well, but they
lied. They chose God over man.
Yeah.
I know the commander says, thou shalt not lie, but
yeah.
But these are still, because this is his kingdom. These are his kingdom.
Covenant.
His covenant promise for them to multiply.
Yes, that's true, but that's not what he did. Remember, he blessed them by giving them houses.
Yeah.
Right? So God's like, good job for lying to Pharaoh. Here's a house.
There's no law.
There's no law. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
That's why. To them, the ends justified the means. I'm serving God, so I told a lie. They didn't have a law telling them, thou shalt not. Right?
That's true.
So God's like, okay. You know, the bottom line is he honored him. Now, that would have never flown with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, would it?
No.
Because they had a law. So they told the truth, and you know that now it would have been harder for them because they in that particular case they stood up instead of bowing down. But the bottom line is that you know later on when the law came, you couldn't have gotten a law around that because the fact that you're not going, God's not going to reward. It's kind of like Paul said. He said one time that they were slanderously reported as progressing the gospel through lies. And he said, their condemnation is just. He said, you know what? If that's true, why would we not still? Why would we be? Why would we not be judged? Because you know, let us just say that let's do evil, the good may come, right? You know, I mean, that's the ends. In other words, this was Paul's way of saying the ends doesn't justify the means. We know better, right? But they didn't. There was no law. So what they did in good conscience because they didn't know any better. And like you said, they were honoring God. So now, later on, if you try to honor God by telling a lie, that ain't going to fly. But in this day, it did. Yes, uh-huh.
Well, the first thought I had was the whole, those who bless us will be blessed, those who curse us will be cursed. And mm-hmm. in a sense, they were blessing their people. They were mm-hmm. keeping that bloodline going with the nation. Mm-hmm. But I understand what you're saying about the law. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say was that in the New King James translation, it says he provided households for them. And the subnote says gave them families.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. It could be either one. When you look at the wording, again, translators and commentators were divided on it. It could have meant that God supplied houses, literal houses for them. It could mean that, because the word household can have a dual meaning, just like it can in today's vernacular. We could say household and be talking about our family, and sometimes you say household and you mean the building. And it was very similar then. So it could be either one. So you're right. And that may be what you were getting at earlier in answer by saying, you know, growing the family. So, so either one is a possibility. You're right, absolutely. Stephen, you look like you had something, but look, I think it's because someone else already said what you were going to say.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that they were doing what was right in their own eyes.
Yeah, exactly. Which is all they had.
Which is all they had.
That's right.
I think they were also, weren't they Egyptians? Or were they Hebrews?
No, the midwives were Hebrews.
Okay.
Yeah. So, okay, now Pharaoh does...
Excuse me,
yes.
Question in speculation, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing said that Pharaoh did anything as far as, you know, correcting or punishing the midwives.
No. No, nothing at all. That doesn't mean that he didn't. It doesn't mean he... I don't know. Yeah, I noticed that as well.
Yeah,
you would think that he would.
There might have been some inkling in there, like, well, you know, they may be telling me the truth.
Yeah. Well, you know, if he was a hard-nosed guy, which he wasn't, he clearly wasn't the nicest of fellows, but he may not have been unreasonable. You never know. But, you know, the average ruler would have said, well, then get there earlier next time. I don't want an excuse. Don't show up here with an excuse again. I don't know. We don't know what else transpired. But, yeah, I had the same thought. I was wondering about that. Now, Pharaoh, as a response, does the unthinkable. He tells them, he makes an announcement to all the people, not just the Israelites, but even to the Egyptians, that it says, kill all the boys. If a baby's born that's a boy, throw it in the Nile. Period. End of statement. Now, that is not what you would expect Pharaoh to do. You know what I mean? Just because the midwives did not kill the Israelite boys, why is he now wanting to kill everybody's boys, even the ones of his own kingdom? Well, there's a good reason for this. It's speculation, but it's not a far cry from very possible, the reason why. The only reason that I could find for this was possibly that for some reason this pharaoh was seeking favor of Hap, the god of the Nile, or rather the god who causes the Nile to flood every year, bringing fertility to the soil of the land. During the time of year when the Nile flooded, they would often throw in amulets and even live offerings into the Nile as sacrifices to the god Hap, H-A-P. So it is possible that when the Israeli women, Israeli midwives did not obey in time, the Pharaoh panicked for lack of time and commanded all male children to be thrown to the Nile to make up for the loss of time leading up to the time of the annual flooding, because he did not want to miss his opportunity to be blessed by the god Hap. So it's extremely possible that that's why he did it. It was a matter of expediency, because the Egyptians definitely had a very developed calendar, and they knew every year, just like we know, well, it's hurricane season, it's this season, it's that. They knew when the Nile flooded every year. They knew it. They know it's coming. And they attributed it, of course, to the god Hap. But, you know, how much it flooded, how long it flooded, blah, 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 all that had an impact on the fertility of their soil. And so it was a big deal. And so before it would flood, they would throw amulets and even other kinds of sacrifices, even live animals and, in some case, obviously, children, into the Nile, offered to Hap in order to incur his blessing. So it's very likely that was the reason why. He had already lost enough time with the children of Israel not doing what they're supposed to do, so everybody needs to do it. So anyway, now that's the end of chapter 1. Yes,
It seems in a way that he's sort of cutting off his nose to spite.
Oh, yeah,
he did. Because of the fact that he said, the Israelites, you know, we were to go to war and they go with our enemies. But mm-hmm. here he's killing off the sons
yeah.
who could, as time goes by, become... Yeah. soldiers in his army, and so he's what
yeah.
he do?
He probably was just counting it as a calculated loss, because it was probably all the boys that were born in essentially 1 month. It's not like this was an ongoing thing. It very likely was something that was just there. Again, that's based on the speculation that it was being done just before the Nile flooded annually. That's the only reason anybody could give why he would have told even Egyptians to do this. Otherwise, it makes no sense at all, like you're saying. So it's not like he was giving up 12 months of births of boys. He was probably giving up less than a month of the birth of boys. Not that that's a minor issue when we're talking about humans, but as far as raw material for soldiers, it wasn't a big sacrifice in his mind. So, yes.
When I read it, I thought that it could be, I don't know if the commentaries you saw lent to something different, but I thought that it could be that by telling all his people, he meant it meant that all the people who dealt with the Hebrews, and that he was specifically talking about the Hebrew kids and not...
That, I don't know that that's impossible. Everything that I read, because I was wondering the same thing as well. Everything that I read did not point to that, but that doesn't mean it's an impossibility. But one way or the other, there seemed to be some expediency about it. So it's still very likely that at least the reason had more to do with, you know, I don't care about the Israeli kids. The truth of the matter is that the Israeli kids were going to be servants, and so it's not like he was going to look to throw them all in the Nile forever. It was obviously for a short period of time. He needed these workers. Either that, or he may have been seeking to annihilate them, but that doesn't seem to be the case, because if it had been, and if in fact he was telling all of Egypt to see to it and monitor it and make sure that all the freshly born boys were from Israel were thrown into the river, and it had nothing to do with the god of Hap, then by the time that the Israelites, 400 years later, were going to be brought out of Egypt, there would have been no Israelites because there would have been no boys. So this was clearly an isolated time period for whatever the reason happened.
But basically, weren't they already slaves of Egypt?
Yes, they were. Yes.
So the Egyptians, they're not going to be... Oh, let's go help deliver babies.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, because these are, they're
slaves. That's right. As far as we understand, they still had, well, we know they did.
Otherwise, there would be no Moses to go.
That's right. That's right. And also, you need to understand that for whatever reason, they still lived in this land, the land of Goshen. So we know that for a fact, because later on we begin to see when Moses comes as a deliverer, their land of Goshen was spared all the plagues.
Yeah.
So we know for a fact they were still living in that land. Even as slaves, they still had their own land. So, whether or not maybe the Pharaoh had confiscated the ownership of the land, I don't know. But they still were living in the same land they had. So, and they obviously had houses. So... anyway, any other thoughts about the first chapter before we go to chapter 2? No?
That's enough to put around your brain to think about now anyway.
Okay, Exodus chapter 2, we're going to read the first 10 verses. I have to toggle between programs here.
You want me to read it?
Sure, if you want to. Hold on, I don't know if I want to read the whole thing yet. Read, if you don't mind, just reading the first 10 verses.
Sure.
Thank you.
And a man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him.
And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water.
Okay. Now, the first thing that probably is of note, of course, is that, which you probably knew if you didn't know before, but Moses was of the tribe of Levi. Also, just a little side thing that is almost never brought up is that Moses had a sister. I don't know if he ever was reconciled with her, but almost certainly he was, because the fact that he was also reconciled with Aaron and others. So there's no reason, because you know, Moses didn't grow up around them. He grew up in the palace, right? So he had to find out who his relatives were probably later, right? But he clearly did connect with some of them, right? So, and how he did and when he did, we don't know, because it seems relatively certain that Moses knew Aaron before he ever departed and ran away from Pharaoh to go to Midian for 40 years, because he brings him up when God appears to him. So he had already known who some of his relatives were, right? So he must have found out at some point who he was related to. We're not going to get to those stories, of course, until later, but I'm just saying that he had already known who he was related to. Yes, you had something.
Well, the fact that his own mother nursed him.
Yes.
And it doesn't say how old he was when he gave her, you know, back to Pharaoh's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the meantime, and they nursed kids for a long time.
Oh, yeah, they did. Mm-hmm.
And so...
He could have been old enough to know.
He could have already... He knew, probably, that he had a sister.
Mm-hmm.
He probably knew that this woman was his actual mother.
Mom. Yes, uh-huh.
And that, you know, he had a kid brother. And because yeah. it doesn't really talk about his age here.
No, it doesn't. You're right. But just when he was of age, when he was weaned, he was brought back. So, and like you said, they did have a tendency to nurse children a lot longer than we do today. Yes, uh-huh.
Well, she's the one that when the horse and riders fall into the sea, she's the one that's singing. Mm-hmm. She leads the daughters of Israel into singing. And then she's the one that rebels.
Yes, against his authority later.
Yes, mm-hmm. later. So.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I mean, if I was the mother and sister, I probably wouldn't tell him, because little kids have a tendency of talking a lot.
More than they should, yes. Yeah.
If I was, you know, nursing my baby and telling her, you know, telling my baby that, you know, this, you know, I'm your mommy and this is your sister and that's your brother, and then I give her back to the Pharaoh's daughter and be like, hey, well, can I go back to mom?
Yeah.
What? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's it. The whole family's probably gonna be slaughtered.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also a possibility. You're right. So, he was. Yes, huh?
Is there a possibility that it was the father's sister?
The who, what? Oh, no, well, it's possible, but it says, I think it says the word his is a pronoun after mentioning Moses, not after mentioning his father.
Because I wondered about that.
Yeah, I think it was definitely his sister. I guess that's possible, but if nouns and pronouns work the same way in, from he translated from Hebrew to English as they do in English, probably it's just his sister.
Well,
Moses' sister.
And this, so. in the New King James Version, it says, and his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would.
So the him is connected to sister. So it
I would
indicate, yeah. That's my thought.
I actually thought the same thing, too.
Oh, did you?
Yes, until I read it 4 or 5 different times.
Well, that's good. It's good. Thinking through it's excellent. And seeing other possibilities is a good thing as well. I thought it was also neat that the sister was watching out for him, looking from a distance, and grabbed the opportunity quite wisely to offer, hey, you know, want me to go find his mom, you know, or find a midwife or something. So, I mean, that was very cool, right? Mm-hmm. And that his mother was paid to do what she would have been doing anyway, right? You know, so, I mean, God's got a way of working things out, doesn't he? Yeah. Now, the fact that,
just to play on he drew them out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was to be drawn out is basically what he was born to do.
Absolutely. It is a verbal allegory of what we would call the word sanctified, to be separated, to be set apart. So and Moses was set apart for a special purpose. So yes. Now, the word goodly or beautiful child could mean any number of things. Almost every mother, of course, thinks her baby is beautiful in the traditional sense, and it's most likely not the intended meaning here. The word can also mean morally correct and fruitful. Parents often have an instinctive awareness of their children, and this may have been something God influenced upon her heart so as to keep Moses alive and protect him. Obviously, there was a prophetic nature to his mom, so she may have just spiritually intuited that the child was a special child. This wasn't just any child. It was a special child, and so therefore was going through great pains to save him. So any other thoughts about the first 10 verses? No? Okay.
I do.
Yeah, go ahead. Please do.
What was the significance of the 3 months? I don't understand. This is probably why I kept reading this over and over.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't understanding why they waited to three. Why they waited 3 months and then sent him to the river.
As best as I can understand, the only thing that I can drive from it is that they were only able to hide him for a short amount of time. So, at that point, when they didn't feel like they could hide him, isn't that what the text says or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the only reason I can give. I don't know. It's just that for whatever reason, they felt able to hide him up to that point. It's also possible that that there may have been some other mitigating factors, like people that knew that she was pregnant, and now she's not so pregnant anymore, and everybody's wanting to see the kid. And you know, you can only stave off friends and family so long. You know, so. You know, whenever people were beginning to get enough of a stink about, let us see the kid, she thought, you know, it's getting too dangerous. I need to get, you know, take him someplace.
So. And he was probably growing bigger, too.
Well, yeah, but
so
only
the
by 3 months.
The size of him would have been harder to hide.
Yeah. So, it's anyone's guess, but it's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. I don't know. I wish I did, but yes, uh-huh.
Since we've already covered the Nile God, you mm-hmm. think that the daughter, Pharaoh's daughter, might have considered it like a gift from the Nile?
I don't know. I don't think so. Because
Pharaoh didn't say it's a Hebrew child, kill it.
Oh, you mean a Pharaoh's daughter?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were saying the sister. I'm sorry.
No.
That's possible. It wouldn't surprise me, except for that she would probably be scratching her head as to why Hap would have given her a Hebrew kid. But who knows?
Well, the Hebrews have been thrown in, so it gave the Nile God gave back a Hebrew kid.
Mm-hmm. Possible. It doesn't say one way or the other, so yeah, I would say that's as good of a theory as any.
I would imagine as soon as the daughter, you know, presented it to the Pharaoh, you know, as a Hebrew kid, throw back in.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What's that?
But it doesn't say she said anything to Dad about finding this baby.
Didn't it?
Not
until after she got it back, probably. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, verse
10. Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. I thought it might have two, Stephen, but no, I don't think it does. Actually, I'm going back through reading it. Okay, so let's look at verses 11 through, I forget, I think 22. Yeah, 11 through 22. Hold on. There. Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses had grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. And they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. Then they came to Reuel, their father, who said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" And they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock. So he said to the daughters, and where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son, and called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Now, Moses was obviously a man of conscience. We know that very clearly from this text, right? First off, he was moved with compassion for his own people, right? And already knowing that there's a potential that was going to put him at risk. You know, it says he looked this way and that way to make sure. It's not like as a prince he could just go out there and kill any Egyptian he wanted to, right? So he clearly knew, I'm putting myself at risk for my brother. And we see also he was identifying the Israelites as his brother, not the Egyptians, right? Now, it would have been obvious, you know, I'm the white kid. You know, he knew he wasn't an Egyptian. It was kind of obvious, right? But at the same time, you know, he was in a very privileged position in Egypt, wasn't he? You know, you don't grow up kin to Pharaoh's daughter without having certain privileges. I think that that's a safe assumption to say. So now Hebrews actually gives us a little bit of an insight to what was going on in Moses' mind. So if you want to turn there, you can. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and I'll tell you what verse when I get there. In verse 23, so Hebrews 11, verse 23, and again, this is a good way to study your Bible. If you're looking up something about Moses, do a word search for him, because you find he crops up in a lot of places, not just in the Old Testament. And the people that wrote the New Testament had a clearer understanding of Moses and other characters than you would just by reading the same text that's available to you, because they knew the languages better than you do, right? So you can get a lot of things from doing that. So in Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 23, it says, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were afraid of the king's command. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin for a season. Esteeming the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked for the reward. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was invisible. So, now we'll keep on reading more when we get to that part later, but you can see what was in his mind. This was not just happenstance. There was actually faith in his heart, wasn't there? There's actually active trust towards God, and he was willing to suffer affliction if caught with the children of God rather than enjoying the pleasures of sin, right? And he considered that greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, and Egypt was pretty loaded with treasure, right? So that tells us a little bit about the character of this man. Also, of course, we see him standing up for these women, right? He goes to the well and... you know, I don't know if Pharaoh was just one of those yappy dogs that doesn't know his own strength in comparison to other dogs, or whether or not he just was a man of ridiculous stature or what. All I know is when you've got several shepherds that are picking on women and sending them away, and you're one person driving them away and protecting them, either you got a better idea of yourself than really exists, or you were intimidated. It could also be that maybe one of the things that intimidated them was he was still probably dressed like an Egyptian. Anything that was wearing those kind of clothes, like the clothes of a prince in Egypt, probably you wouldn't have given a whole lot of opposition to. So, but one way or the other, the point is he stood up to them. And that tells us, again, something about his character. Amen? Could have just passed right by, but he chose to stand up for them. Now, the Midianites were a people who also came from Abraham. You run into Abraham's kids everywhere. They are everywhere. Midian was born to Abraham by his second wife, Keturah. So in an odd and removed way, Moses went and lived with family when he left Egypt. Because the Midianites were the descendants of Abraham. They were not in covenant, just like Ishmael was not in covenant, but they still were the offspring of Abraham. So this is still, they share genes, don't they? They definitely share blood. Moses marries Zipporah and has a son named Gershom. The name Gershom means exile. Moses later has another son by her called Eleazar, who meaning God is my help. But he's only mentioned a few times in all of the Bible. Not here, but it's never mentioned. His birth, when it happened, is never mentioned in the Bible. We just find out later on that this other kid happens to exist. So I'm just bringing it up now. So anyway, so we find out that Moses is a man of conscience, a man of kindness, that he went to dwell among essentially his own people, the descendants of Abraham, and we find out about the name of his wife. And so he's still really, in an indirect way, still kind of marrying in the bloodline. And the two sons that are born to him eventually, one of them, of course, the first one being Gershom. So now we're going to read verses. Who wants to read verses 23 through 25 for me? Go ahead.
It happened in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God was concerned about them.
Okay, very good. Now, so now we're on the as far as the stories go, we're on the third king of Egypt, right? And it may literally have been the third one because people were still long-lived at this point, living well over 100-some-odd years. But chances are this is probably the fourth one. We just never heard about the other guy. So you got the one that was alive during Joseph's life, the one who came up after Joseph that he did, who didn't know Joseph. He probably died, and then there was another one that came up and died, and then a fourth one probably came up, and that was the one that Moses knew, and the people of Israel at the time knew, who is mentioned right now as having died. So there probably had been a total of four since Joseph was there, this being the fourth one that died, and now a new one was coming in to reign. So when Moses went to go meet this guy, eventually in the next coming up chapters, it's a Pharaoh he's never met, right? Because the Pharaoh he knew, who could he could have called Dad, died, right? So now also, the word remembered, when it says God remembered his people and his covenant, there are several meanings for the word remembered, but only one really is it could be held as accurate. And if you read later on, it's confirmed that that's what it means in the very last verse. The word remembered means to acknowledge. It's not that God forgot them. God doesn't forget anything, right? So it's not like you're like, oh, I totally forgot about you guys. I remember I was supposed to give you some piece of property over there. I'll get right on that. That wasn't what happened, right? It says that God acknowledged them, okay? And which is interesting because later on in verse 25, and especially in my translation, I think it actually uses the word acknowledge. It says, Exodus chapter 2, verse 20. God looked upon the children of God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. So the word remembered in verse 24 could be better translated with the word acknowledged them. So God heard their groaning, and God acknowledged it, and he acknowledged his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob, and looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. So God was acknowledging the covenant, and he was acknowledging his people, right? Because of their outcry. Anybody have any other thoughts about what we've covered so far in chapter 2? Yeah, go ahead.
In verse 11, when it says that, you know, he's seen the Egyptian beating on a Hebrew and mm-hmm. to kill the Egyptian, do you think that he knew that the Hebrew was one of his brethren, one of his own kind?
Oh, yeah. No,
that's
question.
Why he killed the Egyptian, or do you think he just killed the Egyptian because he was beating up somebody?
No, it was definitely because it was one of his brethren.
And
one of the reasons why we know that is because of the fact that, see, when he went down and he corrected the two Hebrews that were fighting among themselves, he wasn't afraid of anything at that point. He wasn't concerned. He was only concerned when he stopped the fight and killed the Egyptian. That was when he made the decision, I would rather suffer persecution with the children of Israel, my brethren, than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. He made a determination at that point, if I'm caught, it's still worth it. So, you know, when we read in Hebrews, it kind of gives us a backdrop as to when he was aware. So, so yes, I think that the evidence weighs pretty heavily that he was very aware they were his brethren. He was making the decision because of that. And clearly, you know, it was only, I think the passage indicates that it wasn't very long, if not just the very next day, that he went outside and broke up the fight between the two Israelites. So if he didn't know the day before and he found out overnight, I guess that's possible, but it's unlikely. You know what I mean? So chances are he definitely knew, these are my brethren. And he just made a decision. You know what? I'm going to stand with them. He was hoping not to get caught. Obviously, you know, he looked this way and that to make sure no one could see, but someone still saw, didn't they? So, or at least, maybe they didn't see, maybe the Egyptian that was spared, maybe the Israelite that was spared went and told other people, hey, you know that guy that's like us that lives in the palace? He spared my life by killing an Egyptian who was going to, you know, beat me to death. You know, I'm sure that whoever was saved wasn't quiet about it, right? So it probably spread through the camp pretty quickly. So one way or the other, when he went to break up the fight between the two Hebrews, the news had obviously spread to them, right? And they knew about it. So, yes, go ahead.
I have a question.
Sure.
Hebrews.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah. As long as it's the ones that have to do with this passage, yes.
Well, in verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than mm-hmm. the treasures of Egypt.
Yes.
How did he know Christ?
I don't know. Other than the fact that it's very possible that he knew about the promises, but I don't know. I mean, the Bible tells us that Jesus said that Moses saw my day and rejoiced.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah, you're thinking it was only at the mountain.
God,
yes.
Yeah.
But obviously, to some degree or another, he had some type of knowledge. Of course, we also know that Moses was a prophet. So, it's entirely possible that he just knew it prophetically.
Okay.
So, you know, because, I mean, the word prophet means a seer, one who can see. So, he may have known it intuitively, just like his mother knew that he was a special child, right, intuitively. So, but, I mean, is there anything that tells me, gives me a leg up to give you an answer to the question? Absolutely. No.
I
don't know.
And growing up, however long, and hearing the stories of the Hebrews being raised by his own mother,
mm-hmm.
whether he knew it or not,
mm-hmm.
he had to hear the stories mm-hmm. of Abraham.
I'm sure he did.
And the story of Isaac.
Well, you also have to understand, being in Egypt and Joseph having been a person of prominence in Egypt for so long, and the Israelites being incorporated into their daily life, I'm sure that it was probably part of his training. When he was a boy in being trained in school in Pharaoh's house, it was important to know the history of those people that were around you. So he probably was told what the history of his people were. So it would have been very dumb on the Egyptians' part not to educate their offspring and the people that were a prominent in power about surrounding nations, if for no other reason but to know your enemy. It's important to know those things. So how he could have found out these things are numerous, but I don't know which one.
Being taught the past
mm-hmm.
and, you know, how's the future.
Absolutely. You're right. Any other thoughts? Mm. Okay, go on to chapter 3.
Okay.
Now, let's see. I want to make sure that I read. We're going to read the first 10 verses first. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert, and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, again, like we've said before, a lot of these names were really not named that at the time. But Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and all that were actually written later, written actually by Moses, right? After these events. So looking back on them, they were attributed with names that the people reading the book now would be familiar with. Are you following? So in other words, say that we were pioneers and we moved through this area and this town was called Bradentown, right? And while we were here, while we were here, then if I was going to write a book about the settlers who were here before us, I would identify it with a name that we are all familiar with so you'd know where on the map it is. Not by what it was called beforehand, because we didn't know what that name was, or even if we did, it's not common knowledge to the people walking around today reading the book. So you have to understand that when he wrote these things, he'll bring up names that probably that Horeb was probably not necessarily called Horeb at that time, but it was later. Are you following?
Yes.
So in order for the Israelites to know what the heck he's talking about, he called it by the common name of the day that he was writing the book. Okay? So I only bring that up because of the fact that there are people, and they're usually people looking for every excuse in the world to not believe the Bible, that will bring up things like that. They're like, well, you know, they called it Horeb, but it wasn't even Horeb for another 100 years, or blah, 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 blah. See, I found a problem in the Bible. Well, no, you didn't. Use some common sense, right?
Right.
I mean, this book was written after it had been named Horeb, right? So what's he going to call it? Well, a name that's common to everybody. So I just bring these kind of things up every once in a while so that you know when someone attacks you or if you ever hear this, you're like, well, I already know the answer to that. You see what I'm saying? So now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he had led his flock to the back side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not draw near to this place. Take the sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who were in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to a place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come up to me, and I've also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, this introduces a lot of interesting things. Of course, one of the first ones is Moses is this first encounter with God, right? He's never actually had a one-on-one yet. One of the most interesting things about Moses' encounter with God was the fact that God instructed Moses to take off his shoes. You will see this kind of stuff happening throughout the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, for a specific reason. This is the first of many such commands with which Moses would become familiar in writing down the law that God gave him. Because God would begin to tell him certain things were holy and can't be touched, and certain things have to be handled this way, and certain things have to be done that way, and don't do it with this, and make sure that like a priest doesn't go into the tabernacle just wearing whatever clothes, they need to have their ephah on, and blah, blah, blah. All for the same basic reasons. So Moses would become familiar for these things later on, but the ground itself, the reason for it was because the ground itself was the work of God. Moses' feet were the work of God, but the sandals on Moses' feet were the work of man. And he said, that has no place in my presence. So, and you'll see this all the way through the scriptures. Remember when God tells people to build an altar, it's always with unhewn stones. Don't take a hammer and a chisel to it. If you do, I don't want nothing to do with it, because that's the work of your hands. The rock itself, I made. Are you following? So now this is, of course, all trying to paint a picture to man for them to realize what the law was going to be a clear picture of, and that is, you are completely unlike me. See what I'm saying? God's making it very clear, I am other than you. And anything you do and everything you touch, you defile by your very existence. And yet, I love you and I'm trying to draw you near. So, this was a relationship that was held in perfect tension from the very first conversation that God ever has with Moses. And it's also a conversation that today people are trying to take scissors and snap the tension, because God never felt that way about us. But I got news for you. Yes, he did. And the reason why is because man, his nature fell. And he was completely opposite than God in every way. And whoever is not born again to God today, at this very day, they are completely opposite of God in every way. And the Bible says that they are defiled and they are perverted, and the curse of God and the wrath of God abides on them if they don't know him. So it's a big deal. Would you not agree with me?
Yes.
So this is one of the reasons why he told me, he said, you know, this, he remember, he gave him the reason. He said, the ground that you're about to walk on is what? Other than. Mm-hmm. It's different than you.
Yeah.
And the reason it's different than you is because I'm here. I'm on this ground, and the ground around where I am is unlike the ground you're standing on. Not because the ground's different, but because I'm here. It's holy. Take off your sandals and walk on here with the feet that I made. Right? So this was, that also should be an encouragement to us, because the fact that, you know, what was at the time back then something that could have offended man, now should be something that causes us to feel wooed and invited, because you are the work of his hands. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What you do is not necessarily the work of his hands, unless he did it through you.
Okay.
This general truth is still true today. Anything that I try to do to produce righteousness is still filthy rags. It's still other than. Anything that I do by his spirit in me producing the work, that's acceptable because he did it. It's unhewn stone. Are you following? So this is I bring that up because remember, when we go through these passages, it's important to bring up when things are first mentioned, so that you begin to see a pattern. So when you begin to see this in the book of Leviticus, and when you see it later on in the book of Chronicles, and when you see it in the book of Isaiah, you understand, well, I remember when this was first brought up, and I know why it's there. Are you following? This is the first mention. Now, let's go ahead and read, who wants to go ahead and read just verse 11 for me?
I will.
Go ahead.
But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?
Now, you know why I played the song now, right? Who am I? It is the question that's been asked throughout Scripture. Anytime, it's man's tendency, when presented with a God-given task, is to look at themselves. God says, Pam, I want you to do this. What is the first instinct of Pam? Because she's human, not because she's Pam. She looks at herself and says, who am I? Right? Isn't that human nature?
Yeah.
You want me to do what?
Yeah.
What? Who am I? It's the common human fallen tendency, because it states by the very first thing that comes out of our mouth just how defiled we are.
Yeah.
Because our first thought is always about us.
Yeah.
Not about his command. Not about the fact that the guy asking me is God and has probably thought this through better than you think he has. You know, what are we saying by who am I? We're saying, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know.
You're also saying, clearly you don't know who I am. If you knew me as well as I know me, God, you would not be having this conversation with me. That's what we're saying when we say, who am I?
No.
Mm-hmm. It's really not so much a question about us as it is God's intelligence. You know, you're really not all that bright. I always thought you were smarter than that. But you're coming to me saying, I'm going to deliver all of Israel? Who am I? In other words, what are you thinking, God? Right?
Yeah.
And that's human fallen nature. And you know, and now that we're born again, we still largely think the same way. The very first thought is selfish. It's focused on us. And God is redeeming us and drawing our eyes to not look at ourselves but at Him. Amen? You had something.
Yeah, I was just thought immediately of Adam. And
yes.
Immediately
looked at themselves. You're right. Absolutely. Very good. Excellent.
But is it a thinking of themselves or the, well, I guess even the sense of being unworthy is thinking of ourselves?
Yes, it is. It's because unworthiness, the concept of unworthiness, only comes when we acknowledge separation. Adam never considered the idea that he was unworthy. He had anything to be ashamed about when he was unseparated from God, when he was one with Him. But as soon as separation took place, the first thought was selfish. He was aware that I'm other than and was ashamed, right?
Yeah.
That is the tendency of man. But it's not only the tendency of man when God shows up, but especially when God shows up asking you to do something.
Yeah.
You see this. Go ahead and turn, if you would. We're going to take just a few minutes to turn to a couple of passages because it's so worth it. Go ahead and turn to Isaiah chapter 6 real quick. Isaiah chapter 6. And whoever gets there, just go ahead and read the first 8 verses out loud for me. Isaiah 6, 1 through 8.
In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon His throne, high and exalted. The train of His robe filled the temple. The seraphim stood above Him. Each had 6 wings. With 2 He covered His face, and with 2 He covered His feet, and with 2 He was flying. They kept on calling to each other, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of the heavenly armies. The whole earth is full of His glory." The foundations of the thresholds quaked at the sound of those who kept calling out, and the temple was filled with smoke. "How terrible it will be for me," I cried, "because I am ruined. I'm a man with unclean lips, and I live among a people with unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of the heavenly armies."
Is that the fullness of it?
Did you want me to include 6 or?
No, through 8.
Oh, through 8. I'm
yes,
sorry.
Uh-huh.
"Then one of the seraphim flew to me, carrying a burning coal in his hand that he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth and said, 'Look, now that this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away and your sins atoned for.' Then I heard the voice of the Lord as He was asking, 'Whom will I send? Who will go for us?' 'Here I am,' I replied. 'Send me.'"
Okay. So you see, when Isaiah first encounters God and hears what God is doing and wanting, he immediately considers himself, doesn't he? And he says, "Woe is me, because I'm a man of unclean lips. I'm undone."
Yeah.
And then the seraphim cleanses his mouth, and God asks the question, "Who will go?" And you notice his complete demeanor changed. Bam, "I will go, send me." This is the way things work. The same thing happened with Peter. You can make a note of it. Just write it down. It's in Luke chapter 5. Luke chapter 5, verse 1 through 11. In fact, we're just going to go ahead and read it. Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Whoever gets there, read that one.
"So it was, as the multitude pressed about Him to hear the word of God, that He stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw 2 boats standing by the lake, but the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. Then He got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little from the land. And He sat down and taught the multitudes from the boat. When He had stopped speaking, He said to Simon, 'Launch out to the deep and let down your net for a catch. But Simon answered and said to him, Master, we have toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net. And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. How far down?
11.
So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were the partners of Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, Do not be afraid. From now on you will catch men. So when they had brought their boats to the land, they forsook all and followed him.
So you see again, when you've got God showing up, the first thing that man does is consider themselves. He sees this miracle and he's like, he immediately becomes self-aware. And the first thing out of his mouth is a statement of his sinful state. And the same, and Jesus does the same thing that God did with Isaiah, that God did with Moses. And he's essentially saying, you know, I'm not asking what you've done. I'm not asking who you are. I'm telling you who you are. You will catch men. You will prophesy in my name. You will deliver my people from Egypt. So you see what I'm saying? So this is the tendency of man, is to immediately consider self and their terrible track records and things they've done, and God is always elevating them and saying, yes, but this is your purpose, right? So it's never about who we are, it's whose we are, right? So God revealed, also, let's go ahead and, we only read through verse, we only read Exodus 3:11 so far. Let me go ahead and finish that chapter. So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. And Moses said to God, Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Moreover, God said to Moses, Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you, and this is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel, and say to them, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will heed your voice, and you shall come, and the elders, you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt. You shall say to him, The Lord God of the Hebrews has sent me with us. And now, please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I do, which I will do in its midst. And after that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and your daughters, and you shall plunder the Egyptians. Now, one thing I was going to mention that I didn't mention earlier, I'm sorry I overlooked it, was when it says the angel of the Lord spoke. The word angel of the Lord just means the messenger of. And then in a minute later, it says, then the Lord speaks to him. Now, this could be any one of two things. It could literally have been initially an angel that was there and had made the initial, showing. And then when the Lord saw that Moses turned aside to see it, God showed up. It could also be, and it many times is, referring actually to the Lord Jesus himself, who was the messenger of God, of the Father. And he's referred to that way many times in the Bible. And the word, of course, angel just means messenger. The word translated angel is the Hebrew word malak, and it just means messenger. It could literally be applied to an evangelist, to an apostle, to Jesus himself, or to the beings that you and I call angels. They all are messengers, and that's all the word means. So in context, you have to understand what it means, or what it's talking about. More than likely, this was Jesus, the messenger of the Father, who was not, of course, called Jesus yet because he wasn't born. He was the living Word. But he was still, as the Word, he would be the messenger, the one pronouncing words to the follower of God, which would have been Moses. So that's important to know. God here reveals himself in the purest form of his nature. And that is from the very onset. And that is with the statement, I am. It is the purest term for God. The word essentially means to exist or to happen. It is taken to mean that God is the self-existent one, which is also part of his other name. But it means that his existence depends upon nothing and no one else. He's self-existent. I am. He simply is. Also, he simply happens. The word also means happens. So, I am what I am, I do what I do. There you have it. Take it or leave it. Either I offend you or I don't. Either you adore me or you don't, but I am what I am and I do what I do. It's also interesting to me. In fact, I was probably more awestruck by this one example in Scripture than any other of Jesus' pronouncement of his deity in John chapter 8. You may want to turn there with me. In John chapter 8, starting in verse 48. John chapter 8, starting in verse 48. And we're about to wind things up because we're towards the end of our time here. Actually, we're a little over. John chapter 8, starting in verse 48, it says, "Then the Jews answered and said to him, do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. And I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks and judges. Most assuredly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death." Then the Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham is dead, and the prophets. And you say, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who is dead, and the prophets who are dead? Who do you make yourself out to be?" Jesus answered, If I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It is my Father who honors me, of whom you say that he is your God. Yet you have not known him, but I know him. If I were to tell you that I don't know him, I would be becoming a liar just like you. But I do know him, and I do keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it, and he was glad. Then the Jews said to him, You are not yet 50 years of age, and have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I tell you, before Abraham was, I am." Wow. Holy smokes. This did not fail to have a serious impact on the Jews. It was right after this that they sought to immediately take up stones and kill him, because he was making himself not to be equal with God, but to be God himself. The wording there is very clear. He was making reference to the same name that God used to reveal himself to Moses. Before Abraham existed, he didn't say, "I was." He says, "I am." The very name of God. So if you ever have anybody that tells you, "Well, Jesus never claimed to be God in the Bible," you're wrong. He did, and this is just one of the verses. If you're not a Jew, you might read right over it and not know what he was saying. But he was saying, "I am the I am who was in the bush the day speaking with Moses so many years ago. I am. Before Abraham was, I am." Well, I tell you what, that's powerful. God assures Moses that Pharaoh will not surrender, but that he will prevail and bring his people out, being given favor by the people of Egypt, and that they will plunder all of Egypt as they leave. If you remember when we were talking before, that that this was one of the reasons why God was stirring up and storing up all the gold that was coming into Egypt during the famine, was to store up wealth so that when the children of Israel left, they wouldn't leave empty-handed, right? So God's a planner. He sees ahead and he thinks ahead. The last thing I wanted to throw out to you is that God repetitively, beginning here, it may have been beginning when he spoke to Abraham, I can't remember, refers to the land that he's going to give them as a land flowing with milk and honey, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a Jewish perspective, especially because of the fact that bees were considered to be a defiled animal. So that didn't make a lot of sense. Now, I understand the law had not been written, but the law was going to be written, and they were going to be living in a land that was flowing with milk and
honey.
Now, later, many years later, the Talmud was written and added to and so on, and other Jewish writings to try to explain away why the word honey was used. Now, there's actually a very simple explanation for this. The word honey itself is very likely not talking about honey coming from a honeycomb. Most of the time, honey in the Bible is not referring to that at all. Honey is a Hebrew word that can be referring to a syrupy extract from fruit, or it could be referring to honey that comes from a honeycomb, either one. Now, honey was actually not considered not kosher until many, many years later. There's a number of Jews who, because it came from bees, considered it unkosher, even though the Bible never said it was. The Bible just tells in the book of Leviticus, honey cannot be offered on an altar as a sacrifice before God. Okay? If you're giving a bread offering, you can't have honey on it. He didn't say, because it can't be on an altar, it means you can't eat it. He just said it can't be on an altar. Okay? You know that Samson, when he was in one of his battles, he saw a dead lion, old bones that didn't have any flesh on them anymore, and that in the hollow of the bones, bees had made a hive, and there was honey there. And he partook of the honey. And that was not unlawful for him to do. But more than likely, the word honey was not referring to wild bees, because wild bees were not cultivated, and honey was not something that was really farmed in that day. That kind of cultivation didn't happen for many years later. It was very likely talking about the sap or the syrup that came from dates and figs, which in fact the Promised Land was loaded with. And of course, the milk it was referring to was almost certainly not cow's milk, it was goat milk and sheep milk. So when God said that it was a land flowing with milk and honey, he was essentially saying it's a land of plenty filled with cattle, or which to them were sheep and goats, and with dates and figs. So that's an important thing as well. Of course, if you do just a short Google on honey and the land of milk and honey, you will run into tons of people who are bashing the authenticity of the Bible because, you know, they didn't eat honey, so why would have God told them they're going to get a land filled with honey and blah, 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 and they just go on 150,000 directions at once without ever doing any research whatsoever. More than likely, the honey he's referring to, of course, like I said, is the sugary sap that comes from dates and figs when they're fully ripe. But even if it had been honey, honey was not considered non-kosher until many, many years after the law was given. The law never tells them don't eat it. Okay? So just disregard dumb people. Okay? Hold on. She had something first.
Why were bees considered defiled?
I don't know. But I don't really know for sure that the bees themselves were, but honey was not supposed to be offered on the altar. I was reading it from somebody that said that the actual bees themselves were defiled, but that modern, ancient Jewish writers who wrote, you know, the law of the Judaizers that Jesus was always coming against, you know, those extra biblical laws, they had added to the scriptures and talked about how the bee was not a kosher animal, but that honey was okay to eat because of the fact that it wasn't actually a product of the bee. It was something that the bee made, but not something that produced. In other words, it wasn't like milk. Well, as it turns out, I don't know how they knew that, but we find out years later that that's true. Bees don't actually produce it from the their body. Bees actually eat pollen. Now, you may never eat honey again, but they essentially go back to the honeycomb and throw up. That's honey.
Yeah.
So it's really not like produced from the glands of their body. It's just them going, and that's all there is to it. So it's really not a product of bees as much as it is a product of them out there outside honey. Anyway, all that having been said, I just thought I'd give you some peripheral understanding, because it's important to know that there are people that are looking for ways to discredit the Bible. And most of them, really, it doesn't take an Einstein to figure out how dumb their argument is. Some of them, it's a little harder than others, but most of them are pretty transparent. And if these people, including professors in universities, who actually gave the very argument I was talking about, and if they just did a little bit of research in Jewish history, they would have found that the word translated honey was typically used for the sap of dates and figs. If he'd had any intelligence at all, he'd have done that. But he's teaching classes, telling people how untrustworthy the Bible is because of this very mention of milk and honey. So it's pure goofiness, because people are dumb and they're looking for ways to avoid culpability with the Bible. But you know, they don't do that with the Quran, and they don't do that with other religious books, only the Bible. I wonder why. Because men hate light, because their deeds are dark. And they, whether they know it or not, they're rebelling against the light. And which gives us all the more, if there wasn't anything else that gave attestation to the believability of the Bible, it's the fact that it's the one book everybody comes against.
Yeah. Just like the Jews.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. And the truth is that, no one goes around and turns Muhammad's name into a curse word. Mm-hmm. Only Jesus. Gee, I wonder why. Right? So, okay, we're going to end with that. Any other thoughts anybody else had? That's all I'm bringing to the table tonight. What else? Go ahead.
Well, Jonathan partook of honey.
Yes, he did. He locusts and honey.
Yeah.
But again, that may not have been honey from a honeycomb. I don't know.
Anyway.
It may or may not have been. I know that David, and we know the Jews partook of honey from a honeycomb. We know that.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that was what John was eating. Because again, the word honey could, most often, you're in the 80 percentile. If they bring up honey, they're talking about the sap of dates and figs. That's what they're talking about. Most of the time, overwhelmingly. If they're not, they'll often bring up, like David did, honey in the honeycomb. He'll actually say it. So you'll know what he's talking about, because it was the uncommon kind of honey.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's where he got it.
It may be. I don't know. I'm just saying, I don't remember whether it says that or not. If it doesn't make reference to a honeycomb, then it was probably dates and figs. But if it does mention the honeycomb, well, then it was. But
I know exactly, because I did that with the book. I told before that, you know, God said, you know, put it in a book, the title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for the first year, it was like, you know, God, you know, I just went to the 10th grade. I failed English, hated it. I don't know where to put a comma.
Mm-hmm. Who am I?
All these excuses.
Reasons. I stutter. Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, do it.
Yeah. God knows what he's doing.
Yes.
And he's not, when God shows up, he is what he is and he does what he does.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
He's not asking for your permission. He's asking for your obedience.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, to help you.
Yeah. Well, he's got an agenda that goes far beyond you, but yes, it includes you.
Yes.
So, any other thoughts?
I love this.
Nobody else? Go ahead. You look like you're holding on to it. That's why I keep on asking. Just say it.
It would have been kind of hard to miss it. But at the same time, I noticed when I read it that God didn't just immediately speak from the bush.
Mm-hmm.
He waited for Moses to take a step toward him.
That's right. Absolutely.
That's
right. But God took the first step by showing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And then he's going to see, is Moses going to respond? In that day, acacia, and every scholar believes this was an acacia bush, acacia trees would often catch on fire. That was not an uncommon thing at all. I mean, literally just to burst into flames with no apparent reason. But they never did that without burning up. That's what got Moses' attention. So it wasn't all of a sudden the bush catching on fire, because that was not completely uncommon, especially in that part of the world where he was doing what he was doing. It was very uncommon for it to continue to burn and it not be consumed. All right? That did not happen. So so that's very interesting. Yes?
It's just as you're talking, this thought came to me too. Just even that in itself was a sign that you're going to go through the fire, but you're not going to get burned.
That's right. Absolutely. Which is a promise that is said later on in Scripture, isn't it, right? So...